Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. On our program today, high-speed rail. We will hear from the Rail Authority Chairman Dan Richard, as well as local supporters and opposition. After years of criticism and skyrocketing cost estimates, California's plan for high-speed rail took a detour earlier this month with the release of the project's new business plan. Supporters say it's better, faster, and cheaper, and could save $30 billion when compared to previous cost estimates. The plan saves money by tying the new track schedule to be built in the Central Valley with existing commuter lines in the Bay Area and Southern California. The plan will now go to the legislature for approval before construction can begin. Yet despite the cost savings, many are still opposed to the project, especially here in the San Joaquin Valley. Yesterday afternoon, FM 89's Joe Moore talked with the chairman of California's High-Speed Rail Authority, Dan Richard, about what this new plan means for the Valley.
Where do you stand right now? The revised business plan is out, endorsed by the Rail Authority Board. It's going to lawmakers in Sacramento. Obviously, there's been opposition with some elected leaders. Even some Democrats, though, have expressed concerns about this project, hedging their bets a little bit. How do you see the reception for this new plan in Sacramento?
We're looking forward to putting the plan in front of the legislature. There will be hearings this week, and I think that even some of the people who have had some reservations will see that we've addressed many of the issues that they've raised. It's a very strong plan. It's a coherent plan, and I think as we have the opportunity to walk through it with legislators, we will have support. I'm actually hoping that we have bipartisan support, which has been there in the past for high-speed rail.
Do you think that by breaking down this project a little in smaller chunks, essentially, and taking this new approach, does it make it easier politically? Because so much of the high-speed rail project has become not necessarily a transportation planning issue, but as so many things become a political issue, does it make it easier for elected leaders to stick their toe in the water and say, yeah, we can do this, and it will have that independent utility that the government is requiring and that makes sense from a constituent taxpayer perspective? Does it make it easier for them?
Well, when you say it's been a political issue, I think that, in fact, there have been many, many serious policy concerns with the approach that the high-speed rail authority was taking in the past. I think our new business plan addresses many of those policy concerns. And yes, we do break pieces of this down. And yes, we are looking at some investments in the urban areas. But for the Valley, one of the things that I'm most enthusiastic about is that we're no longer talking about the so-called train to nowhere, but in fact a real project that connects the Valley to Los Angeles within 10 years. And we can get that done. And I think that's exciting, and it should change the dynamic in the debate.
There was a lot of concern in this process since the American Recovery Reinvestment Act dedicated funding for high-speed rail that September 2012 was the deadline. And I've read quotes by Department of Transportation officials years ago, last 2 years, I guess I should say, saying, only Congress can change this. It's September 2012, and that's what we're sticking to. All of a sudden, earlier this year, that changed. What happened there? Did Washington realize, did the administration realize the challenges this project faced? And how did that develop? Because I haven't really heard that addressed too much in the media.
Well, I think it's unfortunate, and frankly, I have to say that some of the blame is certainly with the High Speed Rail Authority itself, that a lot of these dates have been misunderstood, and in some cases perhaps even mischaracterized. There is one hard date that's in law that really can't be changed, and that is September 2017, which is when all of the Recovery Act money must be spent. So that's the date that's really important. Now, to make that date, we have to get underway relatively quickly here. And in the course of that, we had signed an agreement, I should say my predecessors had signed an agreement with the federal government saying that they anticipated starting later this year. One is an agreement, the other is a hard date in statute. So we still are on track. If the legislature authorizes the funds to commence construction by the end of this year, and that will allow us to complete construction by the date that we have to meet of September 2017.
Now, obviously, hindsight is always 20/20, and with all the intense criticism this project has received as the price tag went up and up over the years, has that criticism in some ways perhaps made this a better project ultimately with this new plan, in your opinion? Or is this – are there things that are in this new plan that you really think should have been considered from the very beginning of the process back in – even in 2008 when it went before voters for Proposition 1A?
Well, I wasn't involved with it at the beginning. I've only been involved with high-speed rail for about 6 or 7 months. But there is no question in my mind that the criticisms that have come at this program from legislators, from community groups, and others needed to be addressed. And I believe we've done a very good job of really reevaluating and addressing many of those things that were valid. And it is, there is no question, this is a much better plan than what we were talking about 6 or 7 months ago. Because I think that many of the criticisms of the program were valid and needed to be addressed. I do believe that my colleagues and I on the authority have now moved in a way that does address many of those critiques, and it's a much better plan as a result.
There was an editorial in the Fresno Bee the other day talking about the state of California and its approach to infrastructure projects going back the last 40 or 50 years and comparing how things have changed and how difficult it is not only to get something done, but just for California to have that vision that the state once had in those immediate years after World War II when so much of our infrastructure was built. Obviously, we have a greater understanding and appreciation for environmental issues and impacts of air and water and development and things. But what do you think has changed in California that today, whether it's this project or the Delta or any other major project, that it's not even so much that the regulations and things are a challenge. It seems like there's a different atmosphere today as the way Californians approach major projects than 40 or 50 years ago. You were involved in BART in the early days, as I understand it, and that project was certainly had its controversy. But do you think California is a different place today, or are we just experiencing the same things now that we did decades ago, and it just seems like we're in a much more tense and challenging environment to try to get something like this pulled off?
Well, it's a very good question. There is no doubt that it is it's challenging to try to build large infrastructure projects in California today. A greater appreciation for the environmental impacts is certainly an important part of that. But I think that we're also living in a time when there's a lot of uncertainty about the future. Our state's fiscal condition has been difficult. Certainly California, and especially where you are in the Valley, has borne the brunt of the housing downturn. So it's a time of uncertainty, and that sometimes causes people to have some doubts about the future. But I think Governor Brown said it very well in his State of the State message. The spirit of this state is one that does build. The spirit of this state is one that does innovate. And in general, we look back on these decisions that have been difficult or controversial, whether it was the Golden Gate Bridge or BART or even the water project, where there were many doubters or people who questioned it. And we have a tendency to look back and be happy that those decisions were made in that way. I believe at this point that that will be the case with the high-speed rail facility, that we will be happy to have built it. And And I think certainly if for some reason we don't build it, people will look back on that with regret.
Let's turn to Kings County now, where quite a bit of opposition rests in the valley. When you talk to the people there, they are not only obviously concerned with the project itself, they feel almost personally slighted by the way that the authority has and its consultants have gone about this project. Are you in a position right now where you can even begin to quote-unquote mend fences with those in Kings County and other agricultural areas who are really emotionally involved with this project in a way with their opposition?
Well, every part of the state is important to us, but we are starting in the Central Valley, and this is where the issues have come to the fore, and you're right. In particular, in Kings County, I think things have gone badly, mainly because of the way that people were treated, because I think the High Speed Rail Authority could have and should have done a much better job. And I've been trying to restart a dialogue there. I've been gratified that even as they are very clear in their opposition, both the civic leaders in Kings County and as well as agricultural leaders have allowed us to sit down and try to restart the conversation here. The Kings County is a very challenging place for us to build high-speed rail because the law requires us to adhere to existing transportation corridors as much as possible. And in Kings County, the existing rail lines make some very sharp bends that we can't follow with fast trains. And so it puts us out into the farmland in a way that is clearly one that causes concerns. Those concerns have been heightened by the fact that people felt that their voices were not being listened to, and they were right. But I've been in Kings County many times now. I'll be there many more times. We need to treat everybody with respect. We need to sit down and have the quiet conversations about how to mitigate the impacts as much as possible. And what we can't mitigate, we must compensate. And this is something that I think is important that people need to understand. When they say, well, what's going to happen if I lose my groundwater well? What's going to happen if I can't work both sides of my orchard or my fields? Well, it's our responsibility, if we cause those things to happen with high-speed rail, to make them right. So that means either drilling new wells or putting in overcrossings or doing the things that we can do to either mitigate or to compensate for anything that, that can't be mitigated. Once we get the environmental document done, then we will be legally able to have more specific conversations with people in Kings County about that. But there's a lot of work to do there. A lot of damage has been done. And my hope is that we just come into that community with respect and sit down and work with the property owners, the business owners, the dairymen, the growers, and their elected representatives and see if we can find something that can be workable.
Is part of the problem with this project as it's unfolded is just the system itself? And I'm not talking about the High Speed Rail Authority, but rather CEQA is a pretty arcane and confusing process for most projects, especially one of this size and scale. And is part of the problem people just don't understand exactly how something like this is put through the process and planning and analysis and various alternatives?
Well, I think that the environmental process is kind of complicated. I mean, one of the things that's difficult is that we're not allowed to actually sit down with a landowner and say, look, if we do come through your land, here's how we'd like to make changes to help you deal with it, or this is what we would compensate you for. We're not allowed to have those conversations right now until the environmental work is certified. That doesn't make sense to most people. Most people would expect answers to those questions, and I don't blame them. So I think we need to do a better job of talking about the process and explaining it to people. One thing that people understand very clearly is, you know, how their lives might be affected by something like this, and so they understand what the potential threat to their livelihood could be, and yet we've not been in a position where we're allowed to talk about how we would remediate that. So it just it makes for a very difficult circumstance, and I understand that. So we just have to do what we can to try to get out there and tell people what they can expect, and give them a sense of what we would be able to do ultimately.
Just a couple more questions. Back to Kings County, one concern that I've heard from some residents in that area, right now the Amtrak service has a station in downtown Hanford, and as you know, the Amtrak San Joaquin is rather well used, especially in comparison with other Amtrak lines. Blended approach that you've advocated with the new high-speed rail plan will have Amtrak switching over to the new high-speed rail line. As I understand it, there is a, I believe it's been termed optional, Tulare-Hanford station for high-speed rail. But given the opposition in Kings County to high-speed rail, is it possible that a city like Hanford could be, in essence, shut out of Amtrak service with this new blended approach?
This is a very serious issue, one that we will take seriously, and I believe there is a solution for it. There is no question that the passenger rail service would shift from the current Amtrak service over to high-speed rail, or would likely shift once the high-speed rail system is built out. What I've said to the leaders in Kings County is that we will work with them on whether or not they would like to have a station in Kings County. I want to have that be as much of a local decision as anything else. And in addition, down in Kern County, where they also count on that Amtrak service, they are already talking about trying to have some continuation of local-type train service on the existing Amtrak route. I think that's a very good idea, and I have pledged to work with those communities, with Caltrans, which runs the San Joaquin train service, so that we can come up with a solution, because I know that that train service, as it goes through Hanford and Corcoran and Wasco, is very important to those communities. And the idea here is to build an intercity high-speed rail train. It's not to try to damage those communities that are depending on the train service they have now. So I think there are answers to that. I recognize it as a challenge, but I believe that it's one that we can address and maintain a level of local service that's so important to the residents in the south part of the valley.
Now, going back to the funding issue, the new revised business plan identifies the cap and trade funding as a possibility. You have this initial chunk of money from the federal government and the stimulus funds and the existing bond money that California voters have approved. The legislature has to authorize that to go forward. Timeline-wise, where are we at? What's the next step? And then is there a possibility, obviously more funding is still necessary, is there a possibility that the state could need to issue more bonds to bring this project forward?
Well, let me start with that. We are not expecting for the state to issue any new bonds. Nothing like that has been put into our business plan or our thinking at all. And we've indicated that at this point we do not anticipate any additional state bonds. We do think that this project has strategic national importance and can help our transportation networks in many ways. And so it should be eligible for additional federal funding, and we will look to that in the years to come. We don't expect it in the short term, but we don't expect that we would never get any more federal funds either. We do now have the cap and trade funds to look to, and don't forget, we are continuing to push very hard to look for private funding, which we believe will come forward as we hit those certain points in the project where we're showing ridership. It's not typical to see private dollars come into the front end of a project like this, but it is very typical to see private dollars come in once the first leg of a project is built. So all those things together make us want to get the first operating leg up and running, and we believe that that will trigger a significant amount of private investment to help us build the rest of the system.
All right. Chairman Richard, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
It's my pleasure. Anytime.
That was Valley Public Radio's Joe Moore speaking with California High Speed Rail Authority Chairman Dan Richard on Monday afternoon about the authority's revised business plan. But even with this new, cheaper approach to building California's first bullet train, the project remains highly controversial, especially here in the San Joaquin Valley. In our next segment, we look to hear both sides of the issue from two local leaders who represent opposing sides in the high-speed rail debate. First of all, Mr. Aaron Pakuda with Citizens for California High-Speed Rail Accountability, and also Al Smith, President and CEO of the Greater Fresno Chamber of Commerce. Thank you both for joining us for this discussion on high-speed rail. Now, rail authority officials have released a new business plan. It's cheaper, and it really spells out the plan for building high-speed rail in California. First, I want to have or hear your thoughts on that. Al, what do you think about the new plan?
Well, we were supportive. We've been supportive of the project in general. I think everybody was shocked a little bit when the numbers jumped as much as they did when they started looking out at what the revised budget plans were going to be. There was some sticker shock there. You know, even at the $98 billion level, I think in context, when you think about, you know, one lane or one half of the bridge from the Golden Gate, not the Golden Gate, but the Bay Area Bridge, costing $6.8 billion just for one lane, we keep forgetting about zeros in infrastructure projects, and they all are expensive.
Just putting in a mile of highway cost.
There's $168 million just
exactly.
To do 7 miles between Kingsburg and Gothen. So, I mean, public works projects are just expensive. But I think we all gauged that thing on a relative basis. It was supposed to be 33, then it went to 46 or 48 or something like that. Then it jumped to 98. And, you know, the governor, who's really kind of put his stamp on this thing, said, hey, I think the project has merit, but the way it's going is not the way it's going to get passed. And we need to make it cheaper and faster and quicker and what all the things he's been using as his as a sort of a slogan. So, you know, we like what we see. We still think it's a very, very important project for the state of California and particularly for the Central Valley and its benefits. And so we're there.
Mr. Fukuda, your thoughts on the new business plan?
You know, the business plan came out and the mantra is better, faster, and cheaper. And I've finally been able to go through it and I really look at it. You know, our mantra would be inferior, slower, and you pay for what you get. So, you know, as far as inferior system, they've managed to chop this thing up into many different pieces. You know, it does one thing in the northern area, it does something else in the Central Valley, and then a whole different thing in the Southern California area. Slower, they've removed all the time requirements or statements of time in the new business plan. They no longer say this will be a 2-hour and 40-minute ride. So we don't know. We don't know how fast it's going to be. And then you pay for what you get. You know, I think the authority thinks that the state's going to buy off on this. Well, it is cheaper. The plan hasn't changed. It's just they've chopped it up so many times. They say it's going to be cheaper, but it's still, you know, $70 billion for a much less system.
But you didn't like the other plan either.
No. I mean, we don't like any of the plans because really what it doesn't take into account is a lot of the factors that we've been trying to voice to them. I mean, they refuse to sit down with Kings County and work through those issues. We know that those issues are going to crop up on them later on when the contractor gets on the ground. The costs are going to go up. You know, in the 2011 business plan, they stated this is the most truthful business plan to date. Well, if that was the most truthful, then there should have been some minor tweaks. We would have gotten the revised plan. Now I call it a major revision without any public input or very little. They approve it with a caveat at the very last minute, and then they send it out. So, again, it's this whole, you know, mashing it up into many different things to try and get these people happy, those people happy, those people happy. At the end of the day, the project suffers. Project description is way off base. We can't get back to the basics anymore without going back to the original Proposition 1A and then building all over again.
Well, I think that delays it, and I think some people would say that's the strategy of those who oppose it is to delay and delay so that it wouldn't get built. What do you think of
well,
his concerns?
Well, first of all, it's the first time I've heard someone suggest that it's slower. There are some time restraint or some time requirements for that train to travel from one point to another, And to my knowledge, we're still above the 200 mile an hour level. And if it's not exact, it's pretty close to the original time things. You know, the question I always wonder, particularly when we debate this issue, is, okay, let's take high-speed rail off the table. We have 37, 38 million people in this state right now. We have another 20 million projected to be here in the next 20 years. If it's not high-speed rail, how are you going to deal with the transportation requirements of this community? I mean, we are in L.A., what, eight lanes, 12 lanes across?
And it still doesn't move.
Yeah, and they're gridlocked there. So, I mean, so if this isn't the answer, then give me an answer. But nobody does that. They just say, well, this isn't the answer. Well, let's find a solution. And to me, the most viable one on the table today is high-speed rail.
And high-speed rail isn't new. Other countries have had high-speed rail for decades. So, I hope
everybody would agree that the benefits of high-speed rail are good. The details that we have to debate are, how do you pay for it? Who's going to pay for it? Will it work? And can you change the mentality of people who are normally predisposed to drive automobiles? And those are legitimate questions. But it doesn't take away from the end result, which is, you know, as somebody said recently, when you built the light bulb, you impacted the candle business. You know, we have to change the way we move people and goods around the state, and I think this is a viable alternative, and it's proven in a lot of communities and a lot of countries.
Do you agree that the authority officials really at the beginning of this whole process could have done a better job of communicating and answering some of the concerns like those in Kings County? And that kind of really kind of set the stage for what you're seeing now, if in the beginning there could have been a better communication model.
I've always jokingly said that some marketing professor 20 years from now is going to be in front of their class and going to say, hey, let me tell you how to goof up a good project. And go back. Let me tell you what happened in 2010 in California. The High-Speed Rail Authority, with good intentions, mishandled this thing from the beginning and allowed, I think, a lot of this opposition to develop. They were not as receptive as they should have been. They insulted a few people. They made them a little mad. My concern is, we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Okay, I made you mad at something, but that doesn't mean the project's still a good project. And so I think we have to address those. And I think the new chairman, Dan Richard, and now that we have a local guy from our community on that that authority, I think they're addressing that as quickly as they can, and I think they're making some good progress.
Mr. Fukuda, it does seem like they are meeting with people in Kings County. They're spending more time with people.
Actually, it's kind of a little, it's one of those things, it's a little late to the party. Like I explained to them, I said, you're coming to knock on our door on the day before you want to take our property instead of the year before to discuss those issues and get people ready. And that's why our group was formed, is really our goal, is objective, is to get people ready with the information they need to be prepared for this project. You know, Dan Richard came on board, I believe, in, let's say, August, September era. I met him. I told him immediately, you need to come down to Kings County and address the supervisors. Tom Richards, our local, he actually met with us, and I told him, you need to get down there. The supervisors are very upset, and that was in February of 2011. And here they show up in March of 2012. My response to that is, there is no excuse at all. You are going to take people's property, and that's fine if you're going to do it for a public works project. I'm a civil engineer. I know there's standards by which you have to meet, but ignoring somebody for an entire year and coming up with excuse after excuse after excuse, that's not a mishandling. That's just a pure judgment call on their behalf not to come down here. So that's the way I put it. And you know, I want to make it very clear for Mr. Smith. You know, our group, even myself personally, I agree with you. We got to look at our transportation alternatives and all of our solutions. And if you talk to me, I've ridden high speed rail. It's phenomenal. It's fantastic. But if you're going to do something on this scale, you get one shot. You either, you put your caps on it.
Why do you say that? Why do you only get one shot?
Because once you lay the track down, that's it. Let me give you a for example. Right now, they're placing this track on the eastern side of the the San Joaquin Valley. And for the first time, there's been inclinations in it, but in this latest revised business plan, they make it very clear that Amtrak service will cease on the San Joaquins from Merced South after high-speed rail service begins. A ticket right now from Hanford to Fresno costs $5, so $10 round trip. A ticket they're estimating for their projections on high-speed rail between Hanford and Fresno costs $38. For a community such as Hanford, Corcoran, Wasco, Amtrak provides a service that is affordable and works. That's why San Joaquin's is successful in its own perspective. I mean, it's subsidized, but its ridership is decent. You know, you can't argue that it's not used. So the high-speed rail is coming in and saying, we want this so bad, we are going to literally force this upon every infrastructure project, every landowner, every community, because it's for everybody, and we can understand that. But they're saying, get out of the way. Instead of saying, okay, we need to work together, we need to figure this whole thing out, or we need to integrate into your infrastructure. They're saying, get your infrastructure, get you out of the way, and then we'll come in. I think it's better to be said is, why don't we fold ours into yours and make it work? And that is not what's happening right now. They're basically saying, we're coming, get out of the way. And that's the perspective you see when you say, okay, please come and visit. I said it very genuinely to those authority board members over a year ago. Please come down and talk to the supervisors here in Kings County. They're very upset. They have a lot of questions and concerns. You need to obey them, get them, put them to bed, and you can move on. Nothing until March 2012. At that point, you go, okay, something isn't right here.
Part of what I read, aren't they blending the tracks in some areas?
Yeah, in the southern and northern portions of it. They're going to tie it into the Metrolink and the Bay Area thing.
Caltrain.
And utilize those tracks, at least initially. That's one of the ways they've been able to reduce the cost of the thing. And I guess there's been some desire on Caltrain's part to want to electrify it, and this gives them the opportunity to do that. So they are taking and trying to blend it in with existing infrastructure setups in order to lower the cost of the thing and then probably make better use of the land that they're going to require for this.
Okay.
Well, in the Caltrain's perspective, we've talked to many of the Bay Area folks and stuff, and just like it is down here, it is one thing to put it on the Caltrain's tracks, and what most people understand is, okay, the footprint of high-speed rail is 100 to 132 feet worth of track alignment. And, what we found in Kings County is the death kill is the overpasses. To get over them, they eat up so much square footage that you're basically voiding out a big pocket of space. And so in the peninsula area, I've gone up there to kind of look along Caltrain's. Man, I without grade separation, what you have is all these arms going up and down, up and down, up and down all day long, causing congestion in your communities and in the Bay Area where they're going to go through Palo Alto, Burlingame, and those areas. They need the grade separations in order to make it function. So they're still major issues. If they can't get over those hurdles, you don't get high-speed rail. If you don't get high-speed rail, it's like a circular pattern that they just threw it out as a concept, but the meat or the details are not there. And you have to remember, a blended approach has never been discussed in any of the technical documents from the authority up until this new business plan. It's not in the programmatic EIRs. It's not in the actual document that's being litigated in the Bay Area. It's not in any of our project EIR, so they can't reference a blended approach or the details in any document that they have. They're making it up as they go.
Do you think that the blended approach is not a good way to go?
We don't know. And that's what I'm saying is
– conceptually, does it make sense to you?
Conceptually, from a high-speed rail perspective, absolutely.
From any perspective. When you can utilize existing infrastructure – and maximize its use, wouldn't that be a pretty good idea?
Not in the realm of Proposition 1A, because if you have dedicated track adjacent to the regular track, you can leave urban transportation corridors and so they can maintain their service and allow high-speed rail to do their service. It's two different – you're having one travel at one speed and one at another. You can maintain a high level of reliability, and that's key in high-speed rail. In Japan, if they weren't within 1 minute of their – their track times, the system is considered a failure. And that's why there's major complaints about Amtrak, right, is because, you know, it's delayed or whatever. So my friend just posted on Facebook that I'm sitting in Stockton waiting for them to clear the tracks. Consistency, reliability is key factor for high-speed rail. If you're shifting on and off tracks and moving around, it's going to be complicated.
So would you do if you could design this program and you knew that we had a 50% increase in population coming down the road? What would you do?
I'm going to start in the Transbay Terminal.
I didn't mean to take your role. But
no, go ahead. You two go right ahead.
I would start in the Transbay Terminal. I would come out. I would link up with the Altamont Corridor Express, which is an existing. You know, they're trying to get high-speed rail service between the Sacramento area.
And that was one of their choices, was
correct.
To go that way.
Correct.
But San Jose, the pressure to take service San Jose was greater.
Yeah. And what I would do is I would work with that Caltrain corridor to electrify them, to bring them to the Transbay Terminal. But my focus would be to get them up and over the Altamont Pass into the Central Valley, get them you can't argue there's a need there between the Bay Area and Sacramento to get people shuffled back and forth.
Right.
And that should be a priority. Then I would come down the I-5 corridor. I would link up, bring it on the verge of Bakersfield and get over the pass.
So you totally bypass Fresno.
No, wait. I'm not done yet. Not done yet.
That was a comma, not a period.
Yeah. Yeah.
No,
comma.
I was just listening.
Fresno's a market. Fresno's a huge market. Okay. Now, there's different options. I've even seen some alignments that actually come down the 99 corridor, turn down the 41, and go down to I-5 and get over there. The one I looked at and what people have talked about is bringing a light rail express out of Fresno on the 152 or any several of the corridors that run east-west. Say you can leverage the Highway 180 expansion out to I-5, which has been desperately needed. You leverage that as a combined component in the median with a light rail. 180 hits near downtown, shuffle people out to the station.
I'm going to read, this is because we talked about your mom mm-hmm. earlier, a quote from your mom in the newspaper. And she basically said, rural areas like King County's have different priorities. This is all about Fresno connecting Fresno. And then she went on to say, farmers don't need to be connected. Isn't this just part of the problem, is that the opposition from many farmers is the fact that they just don't want high-speed rail going through their land, going through Fresno?
You know, actually, we had several farmers. I know two of them personally that offered to the authority, if you stuck this on a transportation corridor, I will donate the land to you. They own land up against the BNSF, and if they kept – because they come down the BNSF, then for some reason, you know, the big – elephant in the room is City of Hanford to go around the City of Hanford. They have to verge away from the corridor. A couple of the landowners, both on the north and the south, said, if you stick it on this corridor, I will donate whatever you need to get through the area. What you're doing in our county is atrocious. I should have brought a map to show you kind of what they do, but they come out in swinging, you know, arcs. They swing out. They go to the east. They swing back to the west. They go back to the east. It's like spaghetti on a wall, and that really wreaks havoc. And what we're saying is that unless you can justify it to us why this is absolute, that you have all guarantees that this is the only route, then it shouldn't be done. You're causing too much damage to our county.
We had a gentleman from the Board of Supervisors stand in front of the Fresno Board of Supervisors and say, you know, our world will never be the same if this thing's come. That this will just tear up our county. That it will just decimate it. You don't believe that, do you?
I think from different perspectives. Not like, you know, we're going to disappear. Or anything.
The world is going to end.
The world's not going to end. But what happens is that what they're going to do is they're going to come through our area, leave, and then leave us to pick up the pieces. So, like I said, Amtrak leaves, right? So, again, Hanford has a station. Corcoran has a station. Wasco has a station. They're not even discussing it with those communities about what you do. They're ready to pull the trigger, and these people have modes of transportation to get. And so even with the construction of the what they call the ICS or the larger IOS, we lose those stations because the tracks will be outside of that, go around those stations. And when they move Amtrak out there, those stations are no longer needed.
Let's step outside of the Central Valley or Fresno or Kings County or anything like that and look at the bigger the state. We have a state that's extremely long. If you went from the northern border to the very southern border of our state, it's the equivalent of if you left Chicago, Illinois, and started driving south, you would wind up in Jackson, Mississippi. That's how long our state is. And you have 60% of the people in our community, 37 million people, 60% of the people living in Southern California. You have 40% living in Northern California. And Northern California is the financial district and our government. In Southern California, those people have no connectivity to the northern part of our state. And I tell you that impedes our progress. This is an opportunity to have that kind of a connectivity like we've never had before. And now, instead of driving 5.5-6 hours from L.A. to San Francisco for a business meeting or to meet with the bankers or the financial community or driving 5 or 6 hours to the legislature to talk to your legegislator, you can now be up there in 2 hours. I think that connectivity is vital to the future of our state.
And so what you're looking at the big picture and you're looking at – and that's what I'm saying. Some people might say – yes, people do have concerns whenever you do any kind of huge project. You know, somebody is going to be impacted adversely. But you look at long term and does the positives outweigh the negatives, I think. When you have to look at a project like that, don't you have to kind of look at it in those terms?
If you look at the amount of businesses that are going to be impacted, there's going to be a lot more businesses impacted than farmers. I mean, when you come through the south of town and go through the north of town, you're going to be taking out a lot of businesses that have to relocate, and they're going to have to adapt to that. When we did 168 to Clovis, when we did 180, when we did 41, all of those things had that kind of impact, and that is unfortunately the damage that comes with major infrastructure projects. So you can feel sorry for the farmer, and we should be concerned about them, but also think about the businesses that more people are going to be impacted that run small businesses south and north of the city. And that's happened with every infrastructure project. So you want to be cognizant, you want to work with them as best you can, but sooner or later you have to make a hard decision that, hey, this is what it's going to cost us to do this, and is it beneficial to our state? And my suggestion would be that it is.
I knew this was going to come up because we segregate the business and the farmer. That farmer is a business. That field is a business. It's his office. It generates revenue. It puts money into the economy. So to segregate a farmer from a business.
Well, it is agribusiness. I don't question that.
And to what I'm saying is we're looking at this from a state perspective, but we are literally representing landowners on the ground, the ones that are going to be impacted. And if the authority can't answer the questions today that we have or that our supervisors have or that anybody has, what says they're going to be able to answer them tomorrow or the day after? Why did they wait a year to answer or even come and talk to us? They came in March and we said, okay, you've had this list of 60. I can answer most of those questions. I mean, now that I've dug into some of the detail, why did they not answer it? I think there's a choice why they don't want to answer them. Because they know that there's something wrong in Kings County. And if you're not going to do it right, you know, I know this is simplistic in its mind. If you're not going to do it right, why are we doing it? That's my mantra, is because we're going to all pay for it down the road.
Nobody goes into any project saying, I think I'm going to do it wrong.
Well, I think these folks know they're doing it wrong. I think they know they've got issues and they're just covering their butts. That's why we've got business plan after business plan after business plan.
We're going to have to wrap it up, but I think it comes down to that you're not going to be able to please everybody. Whenever you do any kind of large project, you cannot please everybody. Thank you, Mr. Aaron Fukuda with Citizens for California High Speed Rail Accountability, and Al Smith, President and CEO of the Greater Fresno Chamber of Commerce. Thank you both very much.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Cahuilla Delta Medical Center and Kaiser Permanente.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. On Thursday, the Fresno City Council is scheduled to decide how the city will grow over the next two decades. Several options exist, from continuing the current pattern of growth largely on the edge of town to rebuilding the inner core, where residents can walk to work and to the store. Earlier this month, hundreds of residents packed City Hall to voice their opinions on the issue. One of the community leaders who is working to bring average Fresno residents into the planning process is the Reverend Sharon Stanley, part of a group called Building Healthy Communities. She joins us today on Valley Edition. Thanks so much, Reverend Stanley, for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And you are part of FIRM, correct, which is supported by the California Endowment and Building Healthy Communities Initiative.
Yes, you're right. We are very grateful to be one of the team of organizations that has been supported for 2 years through the California Endowment to be able to work at engaging residents from the place area of Building Healthy Communities, which is one of 14 selected areas around the state of California, to help improve their neighborhoods. And we have been working with residents there in the downtown planning process and with residents throughout the city to engage them in the general plan process of the city.
Now, it's my understanding the general plan, which the city is voting to update, it's going out to the year 2035. A vote was scheduled, I think, last week on the 4th.
It
was
postponed.
They're going to vote again on Thursday. How did you feel when they postponed it last week? Because a lot had already gone into this.
Right. And I'm going to be very clear that we at FIRM work with a number of partners who together are working on this effort to engage residents. They include West Fresno Healthcare Coalition, now called West Fresno Family Resource Center, Faith and Community, Centro La Familia, Fresno Metro Ministries, and Centro Binacional, as well as ourselves. And we have been involved in working with empowering residents and helping them understand what is this huge planning process. And so it was very disappointing to the many dozens of residents who participated from a whole variety of diverse cultural backgrounds, not just a week ago Thursday, but who have been participating month after month over the last 8 to 9 months or so in coming to understand what a general plan is, understanding the quality of life differences that a general plan can have, and in particular, really focusing on trying to identify the values that we hope can be reflected through the planning processes of our city to impact.
Now, there is much support, and I think the group that you're talking about, you support Alternative A. Tell us about that alternative and what makes it the one that it appears that we see the majority of people are really pushing for. Let's talk about that plan. What's in it and what are its values and what do people want?
Thank you. Yes, we have arrived at a sense of convergence of support for Alternative A. In the various alternatives, there are other compelling plans. Plan D, for example, has some positive values that we see as well, but we see the greatest concentration of the community's values that they have named as most important. We see them most particularly reflected in Plan A. And the values that the city itself has named as paramount in this planning context came especially from the San Joaquin Valley Blueprint that was developed in 2009. They looked at things like wanting to create a whole range of housing opportunities and choices that come in at different price points and sizes, different configurations, some single family, some multifamily, trying to create walkable neighborhoods, working at priorities called building complete communities. So we picked up our community residents as we have been working hard at studying and deciphering the multiple documents that the city's planning and development offices have been putting out for the public to be able to use in our education. We looked throughout at each of the plans, and our community residents selected some key values that they would like to emphasize. They also felt that it was very important to have a variety of housing options, recognizing that whether you are at a time in your life where you are young and perhaps have larger families, you may need single family units. When you become older, you may be downsizing and need smaller units. Young adults who are either boomeranging back into Fresno or who have been here for a long time also have been looking for smaller units. And so we hope for that kind of variety of housing options and hopefully configured in kind of mixed income neighborhoods where we hope that folks of different generations and different economic levels and certainly different cultural diversities can live together. We are concerned that whatever direction the city goes in its planning, that we be careful to protect against displacement, especially of the most vulnerable citizens that we have in our city. We also value the concept of complete neighborhoods, which and smart growth principles in general have really been articulated, especially since the late 80s and beginning in the early 90s. And complete neighborhoods is one of those smart growth principles that recognizes we want to support concepts of public transportation. We hope that within each area there would be sort of concentrated mixed use development that where people can shop, they can go to school, they'll be able to walk out in their communities and so forth. And we know that the different alternatives in the city also, one of its most recent pieces of education that it's put out is a fiscal assessment of each of the alternatives. And just to review, there are four different alternatives. As you said, we are have settled primarily on option A as the one that we are supporting. And part of one of the key reasons for that is that there it matches our value of making sure the city has funding for infrastructure. Alternative A focuses to have the least amount of sprawl. It helps us to build up instead of out. It increases densities. It does favor that kind of mixed income development. For those reasons, it also, we think, supports another value that we have, which is healthy air and food options. In the assessments that the city has conducted, the least amount of vehicle miles would need to be driven if we support alternative A, again, because it's increasing density. And it also supports local jobs, homegrown businesses, parks and open space, safety, and again, public transportation.
But, you know, you do have, there are some developers who've tried to create those kind of neighborhoods. They're way out on the city fringes, but they've tried to create some of those all-encompassing neighborhoods where you have some mixed housing, some for different generations, but you don't find a lot of that in the core of the city. The question I do have for you is, what do you say to the people who say, okay, you know, I understand this plan. A lot of people like it. A lot of people are behind it. But who say, you know, you can't, people want to live wherever it is they want to live. And some people really don't want to live in the core area of the city. And how do you respond to that?
Well, I think it's important for individuals to take a look, and the development community as well, in taking a look at the different alternatives, because each one of the alternatives, certainly including alternative A, allows for quite a significant amount of growth to continue to happen in single family units, which is a part of what we're hearing that the development community certainly is interested in. Single family residence units are prevalent in every one of the alternatives. Every scenario, each one of the plans, A, B, C, and D, targets about the creation of about 125,000 new jobs. All of the plans target creation of about 70,000 housing units to accommodate the expected population growth in Fresno. What is true, though, in Plan A is that it works to minimize the it does not expand the sphere of influence. So in doing that, it helps the city be able to manage fiscally because of the infrastructure. It supports the infrastructure that already exists. We feel like it supports current neighborhoods. It helps to bring good resources to communities where families have already said this is where we want to live, and yet it still allows for, as we say, a wide variety of single-family units to grow in a variety of places of the city. There's not a prohibition on that, but there is more control of it.
One thing I really want to touch on before we run out of time here is this whole process. What you all have been able to do really is through this is to go out and work with people and empower people who may have never participated in the process before. And now they are involved in this whole process of trying to plan the city's future. How was that?
Well, it has been enormously exciting, and I thank you for the chance to get to talk about that. A city plan, a general plan in particular, is a plan for everybody who lives in the city. It's a plan for all parts of the city. It's a plan for the future of every family in the city. And yet, if we look back historically, not just in this city, but really in probably most around the country, there have been very few folks who have been involved, particularly with a lot of animation and interest, in a general plan process. That's not the reality anymore.
No, it's not. And you think people think about it, it's like general plan, boring. But this was exciting for a lot of people.
It is exciting. We see residents, whether they are from African-American, Anglo-American, Hispanic, Latino populations, Southeast Asian populations. Everyone, every family cares about how their neighborhood looks. Every family cares about who their neighbors are, how they have points of access with them, where they can shop. And so even though it's an incredibly complex process, As folks enter into it, they begin to feel it as very personally connected because it's related to their city and their family and their children's future. And so we've been so excited to see and hear the voices. We've had many gatherings, multicultural gatherings, where folks have held very engaged conversations about what they want and where they want development in the city. And the decision to now support alternative A, is the one that the neighbors themselves arrived at. It was not one suggested to them. It's what they arrived at. And interestingly, I heard a comment someone said, at the Chamber of Commerce meeting in the last week, somebody said that the Hmong families that our community groups were present with at last Thursday's meeting were saying they wanted a free house. No one said they wanted a free house. Everyone now understands that's not going to be the reality. They understand that the change is going to be incremental, but they also understand that a general plan lasts a long, long time. And so community residents are supporting Plan A. The Fresno Business Council is supporting Plan A. The Farm Bureau is supporting Plan A. And we feel, too, that the market calls for something like a Plan A. If we look, for example, Brookings Institution has highlighted that the two largest demographic groups in the country, baby boomers and their children, comprise half of the population, and they want homes and commercial space in neighborhoods, especially where they're not yet in types of homes that they're not yet getting. Both of these demographic groups want something new from the U.S. housing market. They want smaller 1 to 3 bedroom homes in walkable, transit-oriented, economically dynamic, and job-rich neighborhoods. Plan A helps Fresno be not just a leader here, but be a leader for the Central Valley in beginning to develop those kind of walkable communities, complete neighborhoods, transit-oriented development, support public transportation, and really take us and help Fresno take the rest of the valley into our futures together in a positive direction.
Well, thank you so much, Reverend Stanley, for joining us. I wish we had more time to talk about this. I think it's a very exciting process. And as we move on, we'd love to have you back.
May we invite folks who are listening to please participate in the process, especially this week. Tomorrow morning at 10:30, there is a press conference outside of City Hall on the sidewalk, highlighting again the values, talking more about Plan Alternative A. And of course, we hope that there will be great participation in our wonderful city at the meeting on Thursday.
Thursday
night at 5 o'clock.
It's going to be in the evening.
That is correct.
Okay, well, we've got the word out. Thank you, Reverend Stanley. And that's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.